We are in Portland, Oregon at CogSci 2010, which is the 32nd annual meeting of the Cognitive Science Society. The title of the meeting is Cognition in Flux. We're with Paul Smolensky, who's a professor of cognitive science at Johns Hopkins University. Let me just, before we get onto the Rummelhart stuff, let me just mention this comment here in the introduction to the overall cognitive science meeting. Slogan was chosen to emphasize two points. First, cognitive research is to a large extent research into how cognition changes over time. Second, the field of cognitive research, our shared theoretical vocabulary, our repertoire of research practices is itself continually changing. I think that's a point you were making earlier to me, that there's this flux is going on, so that although what we're celebrating in your particular case here is there are symposia, particularly a symposium honoring 10 years of the David Rummelhart Prize in Cognitive Science, where you and your co-winners of the Rummelhart Prize will be looking at outstanding questions in cognitive science. Those questions, like the field, are not the questions that were around 10 years ago. There's a lot of flux going on. Could you give me some sense of how that's developed and how you see things at this point?
Well, the last 10, 15 years, I think, has seen a lot of growth in research directed towards topics that were traditionally the province of philosophers and ones that scientists tended to stay away from. But now you see lots of work on moral reasoning, the development of moral systems in children, certainly a lot of work on consciousness, which was taboo for a long time. And on the other side, there's more interest in making contact with, I think, some of the social sciences, anthropology, understanding the role of cognition in culture, something that's been part of cognitive anthropology all along, but now is becoming more integrated into the mainstream a little bit. So I would see the flux moving in those directions. Of course, there's the huge import of research on the brain that now is becoming integral to so many of the research areas, including the ones that I just mentioned.
So could you also give me some sort of a sense of what, if I as I said, mentioned this to Rob Goldstone a moment ago, if I put into Google, what is cognitive science, there's pages of answers there. They probably, end up at some kind of an attractor. But could you tell me what it is that from your perspective, that cognitive science consists of? I mean, as I said, if you tell me you're a fireman, I have a reasonable idea of what you do during the day. What does cognitive science mean to you?
Well, it's the study of what we have in our heads that allows us to think and act the way that we do. Particularly in areas where lower animals have no corresponding capacities, but not exclusively so. And because what we have in our head is a kind of dualist mix of the physical brain and the non-physical mind, there is a tremendous amount of tension in the field that revolves around trying to understand how abstract non-physical mind and biophysical brain really are one and the same thing. And that's the problem that I've worked on and that many of us have worked on in one way or another.
So if I if I talk to some people, even the ones involved in the Temple Dynamics of Learning Center that I work with at UCSD, to some of them, the M word, mind, they want nothing to do with it. They just want to talk about what's instantiated in neurons, brain, you know, and what's going on there. So when we talk about those kind of issues, when we talk about innatist versus nativist versus
empiricist
issues, when we talk about what is connectionism versus what is parallel distributed processing, could you give me a little Idiot's Guide 101 for somebody who's not in those areas, not in that field, somebody at home, for example, who's got kids in school and wonders how this all has an impact on their lives? A little sort of quick Zagat guide to the field?
Okay. Well, I find it very helpful to appeal to a distinction which has been very, very often cited as the basis for the development of cognitive science since the 1950s, which is the analogy between the program that causes a computer to behave a certain way and contains a certain amount of knowledge that allows that behavior to happen, the analogy between that kind of software and our mind. And a much rougher analogy between the physical structure of the computer and the physical structure of our brain, where the analogy breaks down in very important ways. But the idea that the huge progress in information technology has all been made possible by non-physical discoveries about computation and knowledge. They have inherently nothing to do with anything physical or directly observable, but they have enabled everything that we see out there in this explosion of changes in our world because of information technology. It's all due to advances in our understanding of things non-physical and non-visible.
So is what are the connections between, connectionism and parallel distributed processing, PDP, and computational neuroscience? Is computational neuroscience the same thing as connectionism, or?
Well, I think that it's helpful to think of work relating the brain to the mind as having two directions with rather different agendas and quite different scientific presuppositions often, but which ultimately should converge. And so cognitive neuroscience is a term that is used primarily for work that's starting with the brain and asking questions about what are the functions of the different areas of the brain, and how is behavior actually controlled by the brain. And to answer simple questions of that sort, you may not need anything very sophisticated in terms of a theory of what software is running in the brain. If the tasks are simple enough, then just simple common sense about what it takes to get a task done is good enough to allow you to ask questions about what functions the different aspects of the brain are subserving. And that's what you think of as the bottom-up approach to this question. The top-down approach tends to not ask what is this part of the brain doing, but rather to ask what are the different facets of our knowledge that allow us to behave in some intelligent fashion, and ultimately how is that knowledge able to be captured in biophysical stuff and made to do its work by biophysical processes. And there the attention is on much more sophisticated kinds of mental tasks, for which the mere question of what is the brain doing is a huge research problem of its own. One thing I like to contrast is something like the study of the heart versus the study of the brain. The heart is a physical manifestation of a functional part of our system that is responsible for providing a circulating pump. And we know about what is required to do that because we know from physics enough about fluids and pressure and all of that to know what the functions are that somehow this physical device must be doing. When it comes to the brain, we don't know what the functions are. We don't have a pre-existing science like physics that will tell us, well, if you want to circulate a fluid around the body, you better do this, better do that, better do this. What we have instead is, well, what the brain does is thinking and learning. I mean, what is that? Right? That it's not the same as Bernoulli's principle for fluid flow, you know? What we have is the vaguest starting point, and so the job of much of cognitive science is to do for the brain what physics has already done for the heart, which is to say what the functions are that that material device must be carrying out, because they're far from obvious.
I have two questions that follow on that one. One is to say, is there a game-changing shift though with the new investigative technologies ranging from fMRI to the kind of stuff that Carl Diesrath is doing and so on and so forth? That's one question here, but if you just hold that for a second. But the other one was to say, when you talk about hearts and minds, these are, I'm thinking about hearts and minds at the interface of science and social policy. People implementing policies about education, about health, and about all of these things. Particularly when I think about education, it would be nice if the people who are making decisions about the future of all these legions of folks with 3 pounds of wonder tissue at the end of their spinal column had some agreed definition of what a mind was and what it did. Wouldn't you think?
possibly. I mean,
but if I went around even here with 1,000 people at this meeting, do you think there'd been any major agreement on how to define this topic?
I think there would be a very large amount of overlap. So there would be consensus, I think, on many important aspects of the question. But I think it's true that cognitive science is in a kind of pre-paradigmatic phase, according to the old Kuhnian characterization of history of science. We really are playing with many, many different paradigms. Mm-hmm. The diversity of things going on under the name of cognitive science is just enormous. And I think it will settle down into something more consensual as to what the core problems are and what the techniques are that are agreed upon as the best ways of trying to address those problems, but we're not there yet. And so if you look at cognitive science training programs around the world, you'll see that they bear very little resemblance to one another. There's so many different aspects of the field that can provide the focus of a cognitive science program or laboratory that they would seem as different as night and day, but in reality, I think it's all about trying to understand the immaterial structure of the function of the brain, and to a greater or lesser degree, relating that to the physical structure of the brain.
And the use of new technologies, you think is, how do you think that's going to change things?
Well, I think that the direct observation of neural activity makes a huge change in the link between theory and observation in the field, because traditionally we had behavioral measures, so we would postulate theories about what kind of programs must people have in their heads, and using those programs figure out what predictions would be made for the behavior of such a person, and then see whether those behavioral predictions are borne out. And there was no direct observation of the device, just of the output of the device, as it were. But now we're getting more and more able to get to observe the device, and that has good and, I think, bad consequences in the short term where we are right now. Ultimately, I think it will be all to the good, but if you can observe the activity of the brain, then the tendency of certain kinds of scientific spirits to want to be able to focus on only what can be observed now gives an arena to play inside your head. We can look at and observe the activity in your brain, which we couldn't do. And that makes it easier to put aside the questions about what the function of this device is. And as I said, I think that we have had to do and are continuing to have to do a huge amount of work to understand what the function of the device is before we can even begin to ask, how does it achieve its function? We don't know what that function is. But it's easier to overlook those kind of questions when you have the ability to simply observe and hope that out of that sheer observation will come understanding.
Yeah, so these are the upsides and downsides of reductionism.
Yes, you could put it that way.
Yeah. I want to look at some of the questions that you raise or you will be raising in your role as the 2005 Rummel Hart Prize winner, thinking about how things should go in forward. But let me just look at something on your website, which is What I Learned from Dave Rummel Hart. And you've got the fundamentals of PDP, which of course, parallel distributed processing, but you actually have it down as principles of Dave's philosophy, which is rather nice. And you have four things here, which I'm sure you remember. One, simple mathematical ideas can be spectacularly successful even in cognitive science. Two, just focus on the really deep problems. Three, in others' work, seek out the good. In other words, a good talk is one that gives you a good idea. And four, it's possible to understand both equations and people. Do I take it that you got this from your interaction with Dave? And could I therefore invite you to sort of give me some sort of a sense of Dave and how you got into this and the importance of his contribution?
Sure. I met Dave when I became a postdoc at UC San Diego, when he was a professor there in the psychology department in the cognitive science lab where I was based. Dave was a kind of shy person who seemed a little awkward with people, perhaps, and perhaps on the geeky side of the spectrum. And I think it was tempting for people to fail to appreciate that he actually had quite deep understandings of people and was a very keen observer of them, had a lot of interesting insights into people, not just of the very professional sort that his models address, but on a more understanding of personality and motivations perspective. He was very single-mindedly devoted to his scientific questions and had no interest whatever in academic politics and to some extent the usual burdens and obligations of faculty members that are of the mundane sort. He managed to live a life that was very much devoted to studying ideas, and that was greatly inspirational for me. Mm-hmm. And his approach to studying them had this approach that he learned in the study of mathematical psychology when he was a graduate student at Stanford, that the way to understand ideas is to reduce them to their bare essentials in the form of some formal mathematical characterization of a very simple system, and to study that simple system to death until you understand all of the ramifications that come from the very simple aspects of the structure that it has. That was an approach to doing science I had learned in physics also, as Dave had learned it in mathematical psychology. So we shared that kind of approach to what it means to try to understand. Yeah. A problem.
I should say, incidentally, that as you know, I only read the first four of your things there. There were 10 things that you'd learned, which are a couple that I wanted to come back to later and see if you still believe in these things. Just for a moment, let's look at the. How would you describe to somebody who has no idea what's going on in cognitive science, and certainly somebody with your physics background, what your contribution was and involvement was in the field that led to you getting the Rummel Hart Prize?
I think you could look at it this way, that for thousands of years, the study of the mind has had two quite influential currents flowing through it. And the relation between them has been more adversarial than complementary through most of that time. So in one of the currents, the idea of knowledge is based on something like mathematics. So this is a kind of Platonic strand that says knowledge is inherently abstract and lives in its own world of ideas. And what we see and observe about the world and the behavior of people and so on is only an extremely indirect reflection of the true knowledge that we possess, and that there's a big gap between the world of ideas and the observable world of everyday experience. The other strand being the represented most strongly, I guess, by the British empiricists, that everything that we know actually is derived from our experience, that we come into the world without knowledge, with only some very general purpose means of acquiring knowledge, and everything else follows from our experience. So that those two currents led to two different formal characterizations of the mind-brain, which were in tension, as those two strands have always pretty much been, I think. On the one hand, the Platonic strand developed into theories of knowledge and of language that relied on abstract symbol systems and rules. The idea that to be intelligent is to be rational, which is to follow certain rules of correct inference. And so original artificial intelligence programs were piles of rules of inference that were intended to generate intelligent behavior. And at the birth of cognitive science in the 50s, that was the mainstream, because the other approach, the empiricist one, had not really yet broken through to a comparably sophisticated computational form.
Mm-hmm.
But then, through the work of Rummel Hart and Jay McClelland and some of their antecedents who were paving the way earlier working in isolation before this work really came to fruition and became part of the mainstream in the 1980s, the mid-1980s. The stream from the empiricists developed into an approach also very sophisticated computationally, known as PDP or connectionism, where the methods of extracting patterns of regularities, which you might think of as some kind of rule, from experience became very powerful. And so it became possible to play the empiricist game on the same kind of sophisticated computational level that it had been previously possible to play the rationalist Platonic game. And when I entered the field, these were very much seen as adversarial approaches to the study of the mind. And one of them, the connectionist one, thought to be superior In part because it was not only promising as a theory of the mind, it was also promising as a theory of the brain, because the mechanisms of learning that were part of the software, according to this new view, amounted to kinds of building of associations between properties of experience, and that's something that brains are thought to do. So it was a kind of reification of the computational principles of the brain that allowed for a new way to do the study of the mind. My work integrated the two together. The two strands I did not see as adversarial, but rather as describing two different levels of our heads, that the lowest level description is about the biophysics of the brain. Above that is a level of description that the connectionists, or PDP people, were using, which were kind of like abstract brains, if you like, simplified mathematical equations that focused heavily on learning, and that through associations of experience. And on top of that, yet another level, where we have symbolic rules of the sort that the Platonic stream had always sought as the software of the mind. I thought they made a coherent package, and that it was wrong to think of them as adversarial. And so it became a question of how to make a mathematical relationship between the associationist, connectionist, computational image of the mind as a kind of abstract brain, how to make mathematical connections between that conception and the one that applies at the higher level, which involves symbols and rules and the rules of logic, the rules of grammar, and so on.
Now, if I go back to one of your four things you've learned from Dave, this number three, in others' work, seek out the good. In other words, good talk is one that gives you a good idea. In the research biography of your award, there's a couple of points here where it makes quite clear that you went out of your way to engage with people whose work appeared to be in confrontation with yours, and ended up with something better as a result of that. I'm thinking about the Alan Prince work, and I also want you to sort of get into the notion of the harmonic mind. I don't want to sort of say what all this is. I'd rather you tell me what it is. So could you sort of navigate us through that?
The days when I was starting in the field of combat between the two approaches, the symbolic Platonic one and the associationist empiricist one, in those days there were debates held frequently, especially in philosophical conferences. At one of those debates, Alan Prince was invited to argue in favor of the symbolic and against the connectionist conception, specifically of knowledge of language. Because he had written a very influential paper with Steven Pinker laying out a very serious critique of the inadequacies of connectionist approaches to language. I was invited to be part of this discussion to represent connectionism and defend it against the likes of critics such as Alan Prince. But it turned out that we had a tremendous amount of common ground, and so we immediately hit it off and started talking about how his ideas about symbolic approaches to grammar and my ideas about formal properties of abstract brains could be put together to do something useful in the study of language. And that's how our collaboration began. We ultimately developed an approach to grammar which involved abstract notions from connectionism to rethink what a grammar is and to rethink what knowledge of language is. And that led to lots of progress in certain aspects of linguistic theory that had previously been studied using the symbolic rule-governed method and now was being studied using a revised notion of grammar that was based on the fact that it had as its substructure a neural network kind of architecture. So that was our new theory called optimality theory, and a closely related theory that it grew out of called harmonic grammar, developed by Geraldine Legendre and myself. She's a formal syntactician, just the way Alan Prince is a formal linguist studying phonology.
And she's at Johns Hopkins.
She's at Johns Hopkins. Yeah. And these two approaches, harmonic grammar and optimality theory, formed a bridge between the connectionist and the rule-based symbolic views of language. And it turned out to be quite fruitful. And many linguists who had not really any interaction or dealings with cognitive science or computational work were able to use this new grammatical formalism to do linguistic analysis and understand better the universal properties of human language.
Let me move from language up to a larger picture as well. One of the issues that still is in flux here. I mean, when you were talking with Alan Prince on these things, presumably you engaged Steve as well, Steven Pinker. Do you have any conversations still? Do you find any common ground there? Do you have problems with the notion of a Chomskyan view of a language module? Do you worry when people start extending the whole modular notion to things like having a moral module? What do you think when you see papers in PNAS like this happens to be Nancy Kamwisch's new paper, recent paper, Functional Specificity in the Human Brain, a window into the functional architecture of the mind. What's your sense of modularity versus a more of a connectionist view? And do you see them forming a synthesis at some point?
Well, that's a harder question for me than many. I think that the notion that there are different kinds of information that need to be represented in the mind-brain is something shared by everyone. And so we're all in the business of trying to understand the nature of information about the shapes of objects, information about the locations of objects, information about the relationships between them. That's one kind of information that needs to be somehow encoded in the mind brain and processed, and there are going to be principles that are strongly shaping how that gets done. And that similar kind of questions can be asked about language and about moral systems. So I think we're all in the business of trying to understand individual aspects of information processing, trying to carve nature at those joints to some degree. And once some progress of that sort has been made, then you can start stepping back and asking the question, well, having studied this system as much as we could on its own vision, this system as much as we could on its own language, now we can step back, having learned a lot about those two systems, then we can ask, are they really operating on different principles or similar principles? Are they really operating independent of one another in real-time computation, or are they heavily interacting? Those are all empirical questions that are not suitable for a priori speculation. So to the extent that it is an approach to doing science, to try to break the mind, which is a very complex thing, into smaller manageable bits, to the extent that its modularity is about that, I think we're all in the business of doing that. And after that, there's just the usual kind of scientific debate about whether the empirical evidence favors or not the idea that processing of this kind of information really does run independently of processing of this kind of information or not. I personally have never thought that that is a particularly telling question. I don't see that a huge amount rides on it, and I don't attribute to it some sort of central place in the puzzles of cognitive science.
All right, so playing devil's advocate for a minute, or playing, I don't know, head of the local parent teacher group or something, whatever. Playing Secretary of Education for a moment. If I'm trying to get the best optimal education for my kid, do I need to know to begin with whether in fact it's a modular mind or a constructed mind? Does that help me in planning how they should be educated, or do we just go ahead and educate them not worrying about what that is and then find out empirically what's going on later? Do you see what I'm getting at here? I phrased that rather inelegantly, I'm afraid, but you get the point. Shouldn't you know what you're dealing with before you try and educate it?
Let me, if I may, address an analogous question first, where things seem clearer to me. I have more direct experience. At Johns Hopkins, we have a Center for Language and Speech Processing. This is language engineering. And the language engineers would like to learn from cognitive scientists who study language from a more theoretical point of view, how what we know about language and the human mind can be put into applied engineering systems so that they work better, whether they are understanding speech or understanding written language. What have we learned that will allow these applications to work better? And they're frustrated because we don't have nice, clean answers to their questions. And the way I've come to look at it is this. They really are best viewed as separate enterprises that can cross-pollinate. That rather than being the same enterprise, or rather than being enterprises in which one is sort of embedded inside the other. What it takes to build an effective speech recognition system is a problem of its own. And you can get inspiration and ideas and suggestions and hypotheses by looking at what linguists have said about speech. That gives you theoretical grounds to maneuver, but then it's to you to, in your own world, to assess them and not to rely on what other people who are using those ideas for other purposes might have decided about their validity or not. So cross-fertilization, I think, is what it's about, and I would take the same approach to, say, education. Of course, it would be wonderful if we could say what we've learned about modularity in the mind or connectionist learning principles tells us how we ought to teach. But it's not that way, and it's not going to be that way. There's the problem of how should we teach, and there's the problem of how the mind works. They are two problems, and they can cross-fertilize. Ideas for alternative approaches to teaching can come from insights into learning from connectionist theories or from symbolic theories. They can give rise to suggestions of hypotheses to test, but then they must be tested in the arena of the educational world and evaluated on their success there. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now, if you were Arne Duncan, if you were Secretary of Education, I mean, are there some things that you think you would like to see implemented that are not being done? Some strategies that you think might be more productive?
I don't think so. I think from the perspective I was just trying to explain, to improve our ability to educate more effectively, we need to invest more in education research, and the educational research needs to be done at the highest level it can be done. And from that, we will get data that tell us what effective teaching methods are. We're not going to get that from cognitive science, but we are going to get all sorts of ideas about possible approaches to education from cognitive science, which then must be evaluated empirically within the domain of educational research. So to the extent that educational research can be empowered by greater funding and stronger training of people within the field, more cross-fertilization to cognitive science, then the better the answers will be to questions about how we should be teaching kids in the classroom.
Yeah. Some of the other things that you learned from Dave here, let me just read it, excuse me, a couple of them and then make a point. When an analysis runs aground, keep on plugging, believe in your intuitions. A little encouragement from someone they respect can make a huge difference in younger colleagues. When you're ready to quit your job, immediately remember you can blow off mundane responsibilities and the sky does not come crashing down on your head. One of the things I ask a lot of people is, based on the title of the book by Sir Peter Medawar, Advice to a Young Scientist. What is your advice to a young scientist? It sounds like some of this is that kind of thing, but let me ask you that question formally. What do you tell people going into science? What's your advice?
Well, the most important aspect of the answer is probably not the kind of answer that you had in mind, but I believe it's the most important part of the answer, which is that in the coming years, it will be critical for researchers to be trained in a highly interdisciplinary way. And I think that young people should seek out that kind of training and put a very high priority on getting interdisciplinary training. What we're really about in basic research, as well as in implied research, is taking a problem and solving it. We don't care whether the way we solve the problem is the way the philosophers do it or the way that the linguists do it. We don't care. We just want to solve the problem. And linguists and philosophers, computer scientists, have spent a lot of time understanding the problem from their own perspective, and we have a huge amount to learn from what they have already done. But until we are able to put it together and create a new synthesis that allows us to address the problem from all the angles possible, then we won't really be able to make quantum leaps forward in our understanding. And that has been happening. Cognitive science is one of the prime areas in the research community where that emphasis on interdisciplinarity has taken root, and I think yielded plenty of fruit. So I do believe that in order to get interdisciplinary sophistication, it really has to happen at the graduate level and the undergraduate level, and not beyond that. So as students are going through college and graduate school, I think it's essential that they become interdisciplinary scientists, because after that, it's too late.
That's very interesting. So, and this, as you say, this is a perfect area where these sorts of boundaries are, in fact, being at least eroded to some extent.
If you want to see the extent to which that's true so widely in science and not a peculiarity of cognitive science, take a look at the NSF program, called the Integrated Graduate Education and Research Training Program, IGRT.
Yes.
Okay, there are 100 of them at any one time, funded by the National Science Foundation. Ours happens to be about the study of language, the cognitive science of language. But what you'll see is that each IGRT has identified a problem and has assembled an interdisciplinary team to attack that problem, and is committed to training a new generation of scientists to manage that entire toolbox for attacking that problem. So instead of learning all the different things you can do with a certain set of tools, which is the traditional disciplinary approach, we give you the set of tools of experimental psychology, now go out and study everything you want with it. Instead of doing that, we say, take a problem like how speech is understood, and take from the toolboxes of every discipline that you can, which gives you some leverage on that problem. And all of the IGRTs are doing that in every area of science. And that's the future of research in this country, and I think ultimately elsewhere as well. We may be better poised to make that transition than most countries are, but it's the way to go, and I think students should have that in mind when they are getting their training.
When I think about students going into this field, and certainly lots of them milling around outside there right
now.
Yes,
yes.
Did you always intend to go into here? How did you get into science in the first place? I mean, was family background, a book, a teacher? What was, do you recall?
I was in love with Newtonian mechanics in fifth grader, whenever we were first exposed to it.
Mariana, how can you be in love with Newtonian mechanics? I mean, what do you mean by that?
I thought the idea that someone could articulate three incredibly general principles about how the universe works, and then derive all sorts of detailed consequences of them, and gosh and golly, they actually come true in the laboratory when you look at them. I thought that was a way of our human capacity for understanding to engage with the world that was just miraculous, that that's possible.
Well, that's interesting, because I could easily wheel out, presumably, kids who would think, oh, this is a chore having to learn these damn formulae. So the entrancement that, with that was did you have that experience with other parts of science as you went forward?
I did. I think my second great love was geometry in 10th grade or whenever we did that. That was again a case of how the human mind is able to identify extremely simple, extremely general principles and derive completely unexpected consequences from them, and give you a power to reason about, in this case, an imaginary world, as opposed to Newtonian physics, the mechanical world, with a kind of power that is, again, miraculous, that the human mind is capable of doing that. I also fell in love with linguistics when I took a course on that in college. Again, that very general, simple principles could explain something as integral to the human nature as language was another eye-opener. So, you know, first, that this approach of extremely simple mathematical characterization could work for the physical world, and then that it could work for these amazingly intricate imaginary worlds of mathematics, and then that it could work for the human world of language. That was a constant source of inspiration for me in wanting to build a fundamental theory. First in physics, which was where my initial interests lay, and then as I became more aware that my interest was really about our ability as minds to do physics more than about the nature of understanding the nature of the physical world per se, my attention shifted to cognitive science.
With the talk about Newton, I ask people this question, I wonder if we've already got the answer, but maybe not. If I gave you a time travel token and allowed you to bring anybody to your dinner table as a guest to have a conversation with them, who would you like to talk to? Who would you like to ask questions of?
Wow. Well, are we abstracting away from people's personalities here or not? Because I think probably Isaac Newton would be the one who comes first to mind, although I don't know how enjoyable a dinner with him would be.
Well, the president of the Royal Society, Martin Rees, said the same thing. He said, well, not Newton, he said. I mean, you have to separate the personality from the...
he would know, wouldn't he?
Can you think of somebody else who you think you might want to sort of have some question about how they got their ideas, or...
I think I would be very interested in talking with René Descartes. The time of where philosophy and mathematics and physics were all swirling together was a kind of golden age that it would be very enjoyable to engage with someone who was so influentially involved in it and so creative.
Yeah. Let's just look at the symposium that's going to be coming up, where everybody's come up with another question for moving forward. Yours was, can we stop denying and start solving the host of cognitive problems in which continuous and discrete aspects of representations strongly interact, now that we know how to construct parallel distributed symbol systems? Could you unpack that for me?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I profoundly believe that the symbolic abstract approach to characterizing knowledge and the connectionist approach to characterizing knowledge need to be integrated, because both of them have a lot to say about the mind-brain. But the symbolic approach uses discrete representations where you have symbols A, B, C arranged in a certain order, like in modus ponens, a rule of logic. You know, if P implies Q and you have P, then you may conclude Q. So discrete representations are the core of the rationalist symbolic approach to cognitive science. And then on the other side, the neural network approach uses representations which are activation patterns over abstract neural networks. And they are very different mathematical creatures from things like P implies Q.
Right.
Yet, in some way, they are the same, because our minds are our brains. So, within cognitive science, you can sort of find the problems which are sufficiently self-contained in a symbolic sort of way that you can solve those problems using symbolic methods without having to worry about connectionist issues. You can find other problems which are suitably approached from the connectionist perspective and leave aside issues that only the symbolic theory allows you to have access to, like grammar. So there are problems that can be approached in terms of continuous views of what we have in our head. There are problems that can be approached with a discrete view. And those have been pursued by those people who believe that one or the other of these streams is the thing to follow. But then there's a whole host of problems where these things swirl together. And you can't choose one over the other. You have to find out how both of them together tell us how the continuous and the discrete aspects of the mind coordinate.
And you look at cognitive problems here. You talk about language examples in there. You talk about learning. As you say, you've gone beyond the connectionism versus symbolism debate in terms of modeling. But you actually, at some point, even get into culture, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of beyond narrow cognition here. Are optimization-based grammars widespread in higher cognition beyond linguistic knowledge? Can they be used to explain universals and cross-cultural typologies of, for example, moral systems, kinship systems, conceptual systems? So this takes us back to you. You spoke about moral systems before. You talked about cultural anthropology and so on. Could you just gloss that a little bit more for me?
Well, the idea of trying to think about anthropological questions, for example, universal principles of moral systems, cross-cultural commonalities and differences and so on, the idea of trying to study that using a kind of grammar for moral systems, I think is an old one. There was a great amount of interest in that sort of thing after Chomsky developed his transformational grammars in the late 50s, early 60s. But I don't believe that that notion of grammar was suited to the problems, and it was not very successful. But the new notion of grammar that came out of trying to relate the connectionist and the symbolic levels together as a theory of knowledge of language, the new approach is optimality theory, optimization-based views of grammar, I think are potentially well-suited for those purposes. And people are trying, myself included, but other people, to use this new notion of grammar, of universal grammar, to talk about universals outside of language per se. So Doug Jones has a behavioral brain sciences article coming out soon in which he proposes that grammar is a cross-domain human cognitive resource that is applied in all sorts of areas outside of language and grammar proper. I think that's a very interesting hypothesis to pursue, that we shouldn't think of grammars as about language. We should think about them as organizing principles for systems of all sorts that we have in our heads, not just linguistic systems. And I do believe that he and other work has shown that there's some promise that if you take as your grammatical theory something that's optimization-based instead of transformation-based, then you'll have more success in carrying that program out.
Okay, so just to define again the difference between optimization and transformation-based, I mean, just for...
The transformation-based view that Chomsky pioneered in the around 1960 tries to characterize our knowledge of language as a set of manipulations that get performed on symbol structures that ultimately construct a sentence or a phrase. So knowledge is characterized as what you do and what you do next and what you do after that. And each of those steps is a kind of transformation of a symbol structure. The optimization-based approach that we have in optimality theory and harmonic grammar, and which really characterizes how connectionist systems work, is we don't characterize knowledge in terms of what you do first, what you do second, what you do third. We characterize knowledge in terms of what the goal is. Create a structure that is good with respect to these criteria. And the grammar tell you what the criteria are, and the grammar tells you how to handle conflicts between those criteria when they conflict. And then it's a separate problem that's not the problem of the grammar to figure out what to do first, what to do second, what to do third in order to come up with a final result that best meets these requirements, that is optimal. What we have found for linguistic universals is that if you think of these desiderata for what makes a linguistic structure good as universal, all languages sharing the same goals for what a good linguistic structure is, but having different ways of resolving the conflicts between them, that allows us to characterize what languages have in common and how they differ. It's a very powerful tool for doing that. And it may be a very powerful tool for characterizing what cultures have in common and how they differ in areas outside of language.
When we were talking about optimization and structures emerging, this is indeed the title of the first few lines of a new series of papers, articles in press in the Trends in Cognitive Sciences journal, TICS. The first author on this one is Jay McClelland, who a Rummelhart Prize winner who gets his prize today, as you pointed out. Letting Structure Emerge, Connectionist and Dynamical Systems Approaches to Cognition. There are other papers with different perspectives, one by Griffiths and Tenenbaum, Nick Chater, Probabilistic Models of Cognition, Exploring Representations and Inductive Biases. There's another one from Alison Gopnik and Henry Wellman, Susan Gelman, Andy Meltzoff, A Computational Foundation for Cognitive Development, taking issue with some of the basic issue points that McClellan makes. And then there's a final letter at the end here that came out later from Gary Marcus, in which he says that he's actually saying that parallel distributed processing models are now rarer and rarer with few significant advances in architecture in recent years. The debate obviously still goes on. But do you think that these camps are beginning to triangulate at all, converging on some sort of a general model of the mind?
Well, I do believe that great strides are being taken on both sides, if there are two sides. That there's convergence to be found, I am certainly inclined to be optimistic about, but I can't see that convergence at this point. So there has been a tremendous amount of understanding of learning that has emerged in the last half century. And I think that connectionism, PDP, had a lot to do with fueling the interest in this and contributing ideas. There was a sort of post-PDP wave that came in with more standard probabilistic methods. Connectionist methods are kind of non-standard probabilistic methods, if you like. And standard ones rushed in afterwards. And a tremendous amount was learned from that as well. And the often called Bayesian approaches, probabilistic models that you referred to in one of those articles, is an extremely fertile research program right now. I think that the connectionist legacy will certainly at least be in having removed from cognitive science this overwhelmingly strong predilection for ignoring learning and assuming away the problems of learning that were characteristic of the early days, and innovating the idea that certain kinds of mathematical systems are the way to understand learning. How much of the neural network apparatus will ultimately survive, I don't know. My personal view is that there is a class of computational systems that connectionist networks are examples of, and that the brain is an example of in the relevant description for information processing. That's what I believe. And we need to understand this new computational arena because it's very different from the one that we inherited from Alan Turing and traditional computation. The part of Alan Turing's work that wasn't on connectionism.
Okay.
The point is that it's a whole new world. Connectionism was very influential in opening it up. The probabilistic analyses are filling it out in certain respects. Where that will all lead, I don't know, but because I do believe that this is a computational arena where the brain lives, we must understand this kind of computational system ultimately if we're going to knit together the mind and the brain.
So I'm assuming this is all still very fertile and of great excitement to you, but is there any moment when you think, I wish I'd been a fill in the blank? Are you a frustrated something? Is there something other career that you would have done if you hadn't gone into science?
If I hadn't gone into science?
Yeah.
I don't think... there was only a period in my life that I can recall when I was when I desired something other than a scientific career. When I first came into cognitive science and was focused primarily on artificial intelligence at the time, just after getting my PhD in mathematical physics, I quickly found out how much artificial intelligence and advanced computation was being used by the military to automate warfare and decision making. And I became extremely disturbed about this because I knew the foibles of these systems. And I knew how decision makers responsible for deciding whether or not to use these kind of systems, they could not possibly know the foibles of them. I pursued possibilities of leaving academia and going to Washington and working for the Federation of Atomic Scientists or any of a number of groups that were at the time combating increase of use of technology in the nuclear theater especially. I was told by the president of the Federation of Atomic Scientists that I would not make it in that world, and he was right. Because he said, you know, here in Washington, you get news today and you have to give an answer tomorrow. And he said, you're the kind of person who wants to sit and think, and that is fatal here. And he hit it exactly on the nose. And since then, I've never, ever ceased to appreciate how wonderful and luxurious it is to have a career where I'm actually encouraged to sit and think. I wouldn't want to do anything else.
Yeah. This, the nuclear issue, of course, has become very much the fore again. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the clock some months ago. A couple of members of the board of advisors of Science Network, Lawrence Krauss, Leon Lederman, intimately involved with that, something I've been interested in for a long time. Again, another of these issues where the importance of having an informed public
is critical.
Yeah, the point I made to you earlier that, you know, it's the science stories on the front page of the New York Times as well, not just on the Science Times on Tuesday's section as well. There's health stories, education stories. I mean, is that something that you agree with? Do you have a still have a sense of commitment to the communication of science and so on?
Well, I think as I've gotten older, and I think the interaction with my colleagues in the Center for Language and Speech Processing, who are building language engineering systems, had a tremendous influence on me in this way. The more I've come to realize that each problem requires its own study, and expertise needs to be developed for each of these problems. And the problem of educating the public is one that I don't know has really been taken on as a question of scientific scrutiny. What works? What doesn't work? I think that needs to be done. And I would hope that out of it would come an understanding of the ways that the scientific community can directly or indirectly, through the media and educators and so on, contribute to elevating the scientific literacy of the population of the democracy. But I would not have the hubris to think that I would know what to go out to run out and do to make that happen. I think that whatever instincts that I might have for how to deploy my resources to educate the public would probably be ultimately entirely futile, because I just didn't really understand what that problem is and how hard it is to solve it and what it takes.
There was an article recently in the New York Times by Jaron Lanier called The First Church of Robotics, basically saying that perhaps there is, and I'm abbreviating hugely here, that there's been too much hype about AI, too many larger claims. I'm wondering if that's one of the problems with the way in which the public perceives science. I mean, I've said before to people that perhaps because of a number of things, there's a vicious cycle, a circle has emerged, where public expects that science delivers certitude.
Yes.
And possibly a scientist and a journalist in conjunction end up sort of portraying something as a breakthrough rather than as an interesting incremental step. And we get into all sorts of trouble, and people start ending up saying, well, man, that drug actually doesn't work, and the depression gene, sorry, no, not. From that, I would derive the argument that understanding how science is done, that we're in the doubt business, not the belief business, it's incremental steps and so on, I think would be just really useful.
I think that's right, but there is the danger that the more the public knows about what science is really like, the less they will want to support it and the less they will believe in it.
You mean that the high rating that scientists get in the various polls would plummet somewhat?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so would you like to elaborate on that a slightly? A little, probably not.
I mean, when you're advising an undergraduate about whether to go to graduate school and get a PhD, in my case at least, I tell them, to most people, scientific research is incredibly boring. It is so slow that you cannot imagine how much painstaking effort and time is required to make even the smallest step. And even when you make that step, everyone will tell you you're wrong. Only a certain kind of personality is suited to that kind of work. Only a certain kind of personality could appreciate that kind of endeavor. And so if undergraduates from Johns Hopkins University are not suited to become scientists, then I think many intelligent people are not in a position to appreciate the practice of science.
Mm-hmm.
So laying bare the practice of science would have a certain risk to it, I think.
Yeah. Let's shift to another question, which is, what are you actually optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about?
Mm-hmm.
I am optimistic about the power of the method of formulating very simple, very general scientific principles that allow us to understand in a deep way systems which seem much too complex to be understood in that way. I profoundly believe in that. It comes from my experience with Newton and then Euclid and then Rummelhart, Chomsky. All of these experiences have just put a tremendous amount of optimism in my heart for the power of this method of understanding through formalization in terms of general simple principles. So I'm very optimistic about the potential of that method in many areas where we have serious problems that need to be solved. And secondly, I'm optimistic that if a number of serious interdisciplinarily trained researchers attack a problem, whether it be how to get the public to be more informed about science, or how to make sure that the decision makers in the Pentagon are sufficiently informed about artificial intelligence to make the right decisions, that serious efforts at attacking those problems from multiple perspectives will lead us to understanding, and progress will result from that.
Given what we've talked about in terms of your thoughts about science, the relationship between science and society, and so on, I think back to President Obama's inaugural address, where he talked about restoring science to its rightful place, but gave no coordinates. What do you think is the rightful place of science?
Well, I think the most important plank in the scientific platform that needs to be well placed, maybe, is that decisions should be informed by cogent argument and careful data collection and data analysis, and not by ideology, and not by prejudices about what the right answer is that are based solely on intuitive or historical basis, so that decisions of the sort that you're talking about on the front page of the New York Times that need to be made in a democratic society by some kind of collective action, that the crucial thing is that a scientist must be skeptical and base their conclusions on argument and data, and not on ideological prejudices. That applies across the board. And so that is a rightful place for a scientific attitude in a democratic society, I believe. That's not about the material of science, but sort of the what it means to be, to take a scientific view of problem solving or decision making.
What do you see in the crystal ball time? The future of this enterprise, the connectionist enterprise, the PDP enterprise, the thing, the nascent seeds sown by Dave Rummelhart and Jay McClelland and continued. Where's it going?
Well, I have a vision in the crystal ball that's cloudier than I would like. But what I have been seeing in the crystal ball in recent years is a cognitive science in which we have these simple mathematical general principles that allow us to make formal arguments about what experimental results to expect from a theory, and not have to rely entirely on just blind intuition about this theory makes this prediction, which is the state of the field right now. The theories are not in a form that allows us to rigorously determine what their predictions are, and so it's everyone's guess as to what whether an experiment confirms or disconfirms a theory. That we will have a proper set of principles for formalizing the notion of a mental representation of an external of external content, a formal definition of attention and its role in non-conscious and conscious inference. That all of the threads that have been developed in cognitive science will mature into a coherent, formal, mathematical field. I foresee cognitive science going through a transition of the sort that economics went through somewhere in the 40s, 50s of the last century, where it became a mathematical discipline with a set of core principles and agreed upon methodology. Cognitive science is not there, but I see a time when it will be, and I hope I live to see it, but I suspect I won't.
But cognition in flux, then you want the flux to go away? You'd like it to settle on something.
Yes.
Well put. I actually do hope you live to see it. It's been great talking to you, Paul Smolensky. Thanks
Likewise.
Very much.
Likewise, Roger. Thanks.